Born in the pages of American comic books during the middle decades of the 20th century, superheroes made their jump to the cinema early and never really left since. But never before did the genre of superhero film enjoy a similar popularity as it does today or did during the last 20 years. Since the start of 1997, Hollywood has released no less than 57 big-budget live-action blockbuster films based on DC or Marvel Comics titles about the exploits of iconic figures like Superman, Spider-Man, Batman, or super teams like the Avengers, the X-Men, or the Fantastic Four. Several of these films currently count among the most profitable Hollywood productions of the last decades, with titles like The Dark Knight Rises or Captain America Civil War grossing more than $1 billion during their theatrical runs alone. Concurrently, the term superhero blockbuster has changed its meaning, and as German author Dietmar Dart has noted, in recent years undergone a diversification into subcategories. As a result, the term superhero movie can now apply to films like science fiction adventures like Guardians of the Galaxy, conspiracy thrillers like Captain America, The Winter Soldier, heist movies like Ant-Man, or historical ensemble pieces set against the backdrop of the Cold War like X-Men First Class. And as of now, there's no reason to expect that this type of film is going to go away soon, as at least 36 additional superhero blockbusters are currently in various stages of pre-production and lined up for release until the end of 2022. So it's only apt that media scholar Dan Hassler-Forrest has characterized the superhero movie as a dominant genre in 21st century Hollywood cinema. And beyond this mounting of box office returns and an omnipresence in the production slates of the Hollywood studios, the dominance of this genre also expresses itself in a wealth of related cultural activity that clusters around new releases in the genre. Superhero movies are privileged objects for the various overlapping media publics of the early 21st century, and as such, they garner the attention of interested observers that incessantly comment on, discuss, dismiss, or promote them. This conversation occurs in the various on- and offline fora of fan communities, as well as in journalistic coverage by mainstream press publications and entertainment news websites with a focus on popular culture, as well as in topical publications by academics and professional critics. Collectively, all of these discourses provide a constant coverage of production news, speculations about upcoming releases, commentary, criticism, and analysis. They trace references to comic book source materials or decipher deeper levels of meaning, and they try to come to terms with the reasons for the popularity of superhero blockbuster films. And they also provide fan fiction in various forms and guises. And my project does a little bit of all of this also. So, superhero blockbuster films, in other words, are a global pop cultural phenomenon and at the center of a wide-ranging mobilization that involves these discourses about popular culture, as well as enormous amounts of capital, countless industrial and creative actors, and the members of a diverse international audience. And tonight, I want to take a closer look at these type of film and discuss some of the defining aspects of their aesthetic practice, to explore what exactly these films do to afford this position at the center of this large-scale cultural mobilization. Okay, and in doing so, talk today is basically one version of trying to pitch you my dissertation project, which I've been working on for the almost for the last 4 years, actually a bit longer. Peter just mentioned the title, so I don't have to read it out once more. And in a general sense, the project that I've been working on for the last couple of years tries to do exactly this. It tries to explain the superhero blockbuster phenomenon. And it does so by observing the interactions between superhero blockbusters and their cultural environment. And I'm going to talk about this quite a bit more in what follows now. So, more precisely, my project sets out to examine how exactly these films interact with their cultural environment, and it scrutinizes the narrative, thematic, and film aesthetic means by which these productions appeal to their consumers, explores how these films prompt discussion and debate within the discourses that surround them, and considers how these films manage to resonate with the members of an online fan culture. In a general sense, I argue that the current popularity of the genre is at least partly the result of their ability to exert a modicum of control over their own reception. And that these films share a number of medial, formal, and thematic habits and tendencies that allow them to pre-structure the reception practices of their viewers in a particular manner. So my project therefore argues that the commercial successes of these films rests on their ability to encourage and sustain this incessant cultural activity that surrounds them. Superhero blockbusters, in other words, are involved in a project of viewer mobilization and management that I discuss as a politics of audience engagement, which is there in my title. And I will talk about what this means in a bit. So in what follows, I will present you with like some of the arguments, not all of them, that I develop over the course of the chapters of my thesis. And I consider different dimensions of the aesthetic practice of superhero blockbuster films. For example, the narrative dimensions, how these films tell their stories, and how they connect different films and different media into larger serial clusters of related media content. I also talk about the thematic dimension of these films and how these films manage to resonate with diverse audiences, and how some of these films actually tackle current political themes and debates, and nonetheless manage to be able to accommodate a wide variety of viewers with very different political leanings. So they engage in something that I call a cinematic populism. Another chapter observes more precisely how these films insert themselves in the practices of an online fan culture. And then because it's an academic work, I also have some concepts and theory there that I will also throw at you in a minute. Also have a conclusion. All right. So before I go into detail about this, one thing. So my project is about superhero blockbusters of the last 20 years, films based on DC and Marvel comic books. But tonight I will mostly talk about Marvel movies. But we can, if you have like other films that you'd like to discuss, I will be happy to do so afterwards. All right. So what is a superhero blockbuster? So in my usage, as I just said, I only focus on blockbuster films based on titles, figures, and properties owned by DC Comics or Marvel Comics, which are the United States' biggest publishers of comic books, with long histories in the field of publishing superhero comics and other types of comics. So as such, these films are adaptations of these comics titles, and they try to appeal to the audience's pre-existing familiarity with these figures and properties. They're also products of what Thomas Schatz has called conglomerate Hollywood. That is, they're produced by one of the big six Hollywood studios. And all of these studios are part of larger multinational entertainment corporations that have branches in other media. Accordingly, all of these superhero blockbusters are in some way part of larger entertainment franchises. And they connect directly or indirectly to other superhero narratives in other media that are usually produced by other branches of these larger entertainment firms, including comics, television, and digital games. But it really there's no end to it, really. There are also big budget, special effects heavy blockbuster films, obviously, and as such, they belong to a tradition of blockbuster cinema that usually a type of films that usually comes at higher production costs and it is intended to yield higher profits than other types of movie. These films also represent a type of cinema that, as Julian Stringer has put it, promises to fulfill viewer expectations for quote-unquote outsized spectacle through an emphasis on fast-paced action and state-of-the-art visual effects. And in addition, and unlike other types of contemporary blockbuster cinema, though this is increasingly more the case, these films are all designed from the outset as part of ongoing film series. And they, if they're profitable, they usually yield sequels or spin-off movies, or even less profitable examples of the genre are usually rebooted to start over again with new directors, new casts, until all the elements for mainstream success are in place. So these are inherently serial types of films. Or, as Frank Kelleher has put it, they are serial narratives in the sense of heavily schematized, mass-addressed, industrial-produced, continuing narratives. And unlike other types of popular fiction, serial narratives do not usually or primarily exist as stable text or self-contained works of art. They are instead better understood as dynamic systems that operate over an extended period of time and which bring together a number of different actors and agencies. This dynamic and interactional character manifests itself most obviously in the fact that these films unfold in a recursive interaction with their own reception, which means that the responses of audiences can inform the production of future installments of a series. So normally, the production of later entries in the film series begins while the film is still in theaters or circulates through ancillary markets for home video. And the reactions of viewers or the general reception, mediated through box office returns, through reviews, or through activity on social media, can feed back into the production process. And accordingly, studio executives, filmmakers, and marketers can try to gauge the reception and adjust their own aesthetic practice accordingly. And the network-like character of serial narratives also comes to the fore in the many fan activities they inspire. As Frank Heller and Daniel Stein have put it, serial narratives generally release creative practices on the part of the audience. And this includes things like the participation in online forums or posting about your favorite film on Facebook, but also going to comic book convention, participating in the media of a fan culture, or creating fan fiction or fan videos on YouTube, for example. Oops. By inspiring such practices, these films contribute to the shaping of a cultural environment that can sustain the further unfolding, and thereby these films create some of the preconditions for their own existence. And to account for these facts, Kelleher and Stein have discussed serial narratives as actor networks in the sense of Bruno Latour's actor network theory. Similarly, Ruth Meyer has called serial narratives, by invoking the Deleuzian notion of the machine, as quote-unquote contractions or ensembles that conjoin living beings and technological apparatuses into intricately layered arrangements of interaction. And this is a complicated way of saying that series evolve over time. And it doesn't make sense to, for example, look at six films of a film series and consider them like a book, like a stable text that is not evolving, because the defining aspects of serial narratives especially always result from their public reception and the way that these films try to position themselves with regard to the audience. Okay. So all of this is obviously bound up with the explicitly commercial character of serial narratives, which is to say that the continuation of a series depends on market performance and commercial success. So if audiences stop paying attention, series simply stop and don't release new examples. Why? So like series in other media, superhero film series need to find ways to ensure the long-term engagement of viewers. And these commercial imperatives also informed a basic dialectic between repetition and variation that scholars like Umberto Eco have identified as central to serial narratives in all media and periods. Although, yeah, that's problematic, but let's go with it. So in order to retain interest over time, series need to offer the same kind of pleasures on a regular basis. At the same time, each new film, each new installment needs to add an element of novelty that makes it noticeably different from what came before. And superhero film series, or serial narratives in general, need to find ways to accommodate this tension between repetition and variation, between identity and difference. And obviously, they also need to engage audiences across the break between installments from one film to the next, from one medium to the other. And the most obvious way by which serial narratives do that is the device, are devices like the cliffhanger. Can someone of you give me a definition of the cliffhanger to make this participatory and interactive? Do you guys know what a cliffhanger is? Can you define it for me? Nobody can define a cliffhanger? I'm going to wait for the definition now. Yeah.
Well, I would say it's the situation where the story is cut in a moment of tension, so that you get, so that the viewer gets expectations towards what's going to happen next.
Right, this is exactly the kind of definition that I have here in my script. It's like the suspension of narration on a moment of heightened dramatic tension. And then you return the next week or the next year to see how things turn out. These devices are the basic elements of what I call the politics of engagement, which is my term for all the different ways in which serial narratives try to keep you coming back to the text, try to keep you engaged. Or in a more abstract way, the devices by which serial narratives try to align the reception practices of their viewers with the commercial imperatives that inform their production. This includes more than just cliffhangers, however. Serial narratives also need to constantly build and expand their audiences and need to recruit new viewers all the time in order to stay profitable. They thus also have to create a kind of publicity and public awareness, which means that they have to position themselves in a competitive environment against other film series, and they have to be reviewed by, for example, major newspapers or entertainment news websites. They have to be able to catch your attention somehow. So what I call politics of engagement refers to all those things, all those practices that aim in the superhero movies or other serial narratives that aim at producing this effect, that aim at like luring you in, or that aim at creating a kind of publicity for serial narratives. Okay. So in my dissertation, I look at, as I just mentioned, different aspects of these politics of engagement. And I develop this kind of interest in a critical, by way of a critical engagement, there's the word again, engagement, with the work of American media scholar Henry Jenkins. So in his 2000, does anybody of you know Henry Jenkins? Great, cool. Yeah, okay, I'm totally in teacher mode now. I'm going back to script now. I see it doesn't really take here. All right. So in his 2013 study, Spreadable Media, Jenkins and his collaborators Sam Ford and Joshua Green argue that the commercial popular culture of the digital era operates according to an engagement-based paradigm, and this is their term. And under this paradigm, the audience is seen as a collective of active agents whose labor may generate alternative forms of market value. So according to Jenkins, and he says this is the case for digital media, digital popular culture, commercial media properties target an audience of socially networked users rather than isolated and passive consumers. And these networked communities of users could determine how content circulates within our culture by sharing it on social media, by talking about it, by staying engaged with certain kinds of content. Accordingly, Jenkins argues, producers would have to be more attuned to the demands and taste interests of consumers, and consumers would have a greater degree of agency than in earlier ages of mass culture. So commercial success would hinge on the ability of a media object to function as a cultural attractor that inspires the wealth of related cultural activity. And in his earlier study, Convergence Culture, Jenkins makes basically the same argument and suggests that media content is nowadays designed to be discussed, dissected, predicted, and critiqued. And Jenkins in particular argues that serial narratives and transmedial entertainment franchises, so franchises that span various media, are very good at doing this and are successful precisely because they manage to inspire a great deal of debate and discussion. So this is a useful starting point for my attempt to explain the popularity of superhero blockbusters, but also it's problematic because Henry Jenkins is a kind of an optimistic guy, and he views all of these developments and digital era popular culture generally as fundamentally democratic and participatory, and more so than the mass culture of preceding decades. Christian Fuchs has noted that such an optimistic view of participatory culture is only possible because Jenkins ignores aspects of political economy, and particularly the fact that industrial attempts to capitalize on the activities of media audiences can also be understood as a form of exploitation. Along these lines, Abigail de Kosnick has argued that the culturally productive practices of fans can be understood as a form of what Tiziana Terranova has termed free labor. From this perspective, fan practices and audience activity appears a form of unpaid but voluntarily given cultural work that performs a promotional function for the media objects to which it relates and which by which it is inspired. More generally speaking, digital era popular culture, as described by Jenkins, could also be seen as informed by business practices that include attempts to closely monitor consumers' activities, demands, and social connections in order to align these more closely with corporate interests. And there's a number of ways to frame this in their study on the new spirit of capitalism. For example, the French sociologists Luc Boltanski and F. Schiapello have argued that neoliberal business practices and management discourses advocate precisely such an idea of how to deal with consumers, that in order to be able to do good businesses, you need to closely monitor what consumers want and do, and then you can exert some kind of managerial control over the practices of audiences or consumers. And similarly, and more recently, Yann Mullier-Boutan's book on cognitive capitalism has sketched this logic as the logic of an economic regime that thrives on the valorization of immaterial labor and intellectual property. And on the attempt to factor in things that are outside of economic exchanges into processes of capital accumulation. So from all of these perspectives, these practices of media audiences can be understood as an untapped economic resource or potential that can be exploited by industrial actors or corporations. So, all right. Proceeding from this background, I try to combine these two perspectives and argue that this is indeed the case, what Jenkins says. Superhero blockbusters and other pieces of contemporary popular culture try to act as so-called cultural attractors that inspire and bundle a variety of culturally and textually productive audience practices. But rather than accepting this vision of a democratic participatory culture that Jenkins lays out, where these practices arise spontaneously in response to popular media, I would suggest that superhero blockbusters and other kinds of contemporary popular culture actively and purposefully invite, encourage, reward, and solicit such an active behavior on the part of their audiences. And they do so in order to bring the practices of viewers into the service of their own promotion. So superhero blockbusters want you to consume series and franchises rather than individual films, want to be talked about and discussed, and try to maintain their popularity by circulating ideas and images that are then taken up by other actors, by members of the audience, and circulated further. And I think I want to argue that, yes, I think I've said that. I want to argue that the aesthetics of superhero blockbusters are centrally informed by this project of trying to engage audiences and trying to inspire cultural activity that can then be channeled into these capitalist valorization processes. All right, okay, this is the abstract and theoretical framework. And I'm going to talk about how I discuss this with regards to the things that superhero movies do. So in the first actual chapter on superhero movies in my dissertation, which is called, So after the introduction and the first chapter, which covers what I just gave to you in a nutshell, the second chapter of my dissertation turns to the narrative strategies of superhero movies and discusses them as a central dimension of this politics of engagement. And the whole chapter offers a bird's eye view of the genre of superhero blockbusters as a whole, beginning in 1978 with the release of Richard Donner's Superman, which was also already designed as the first installment in a longer series of superhero movies. And it argues that superhero blockbusters generally adhere to what I call a hyper-referential style of storytelling. This hyper-referential style revolves around a constant referencing of source materials, of preceding or upcoming installments of series, and of related superhero narratives in other media. So these films want to be read and consumed alongside other texts. My chapter furthermore argues that while this is the case in all superhero movies, this trend has intensified, or this style has intensified and been radicalized by releases of the last 20 years. So 21st century superhero blockbusters obviously present themselves as nodes in networks of related media text rather than as self-contained works of art. And their narrative logics, their storytelling logics, encourage this kind of serial engagement with larger clusters of related media and content. And in many ways, the best example of this kind of intensified hyper-referential storytelling can be found in the films and other entries of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Do you guys know the Marvel Cinematic Universe? No? Vanessa, can you explain to us what is it?
We see it there. It's Stark's Iron Man. It's a huge couple of the connected superhero movies from Marvel.
Right. Yeah. Starts in. It's right now. It's 15 superhero movies. They all connect to each other. That share what narratologist Marie Laurine has called a transmedial story world. Which is a shared narrative world or diegesis where characters, events, objects, and internal rules and laws are shared by all of these texts, and also kind of a loose time frame that connects all of these movies. And Peter Wiegnold has recently written a book about this, which I think I still have here. That covers all of this brilliantly. If you want to know more about the Marvel Cinematic Universe, you should read Peter's book. And Peter discusses this kind of logic as a hyper-series and describes it as a narrative architecture that has a hierarchical structure in which... Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Aside from these films, I'm getting ahead of myself. Aside from these films, it also encompasses 6 television shows on ABC and Netflix, as well as... a number of short films that are released as bonus content on Blu-ray releases of the genre, of the films, and a number of other transmedia tie-ins, and about over 50 by now tie-in comic books. And I think you have seen this slide once before. Don't tell anybody. All right. So, and Peter has discussed this as a hyper-series, that is a hierarchical structure that unites these different interconnected sub-series or Binnenserien under the umbrella of a shared cinematic universe. So within this order, you have several nominally separate series, like Iron Man films, Captain America films, and Thor films, for example, but all of them connect, and chains of cause and effect radiate out across the series, from one film to the other, from one series to the next, and from the cinema across the other parts of the franchise. So that a film like, Avengers, for example, brings these different heroes together for a shared adventure and starts a loose subplot that is then developed further in films that follow. And there's also a number of smaller characters that form the connective tissue between these different movies and TV shows and other parts of the franchise, like the character of Peggy Carter, for example. He's introduced in the first Captain America film and then successively appears in all media in a short film, in another Captain America film. Then she gets her own series on ABC for 2 seasons, appears in Ant-Man and also in the Ant-Man Prelude comic book, for example. So all of these texts relate to each other also through more subtle references on the level of dialogue or mise-en-scène or the set design. And they also link these different franchise entries into this larger narrative whole. And despite this fairly complex narrative structure, the different parts of the franchise can nonetheless easily be joined without an in-depth knowledge of the rest. So the films still tell relatively self-contained stories where there's a lot of references to other media and other text embedded in there, but usually not in important moments. And there is still usually a conflict between a hero and a villain that is resolved by the end of the film. So they are self-contained narrative units. Also, the things that appear in the movies are more important for the franchise than the things that appear in the TV series and the comic books. So the TV shows, the comics, and the one-shots constantly reference the movies, but the movies almost never reference the other parts of the franchise, so it's asymmetrical in a way. And this is designed to enable a kind of a modular quality or non-linear form of narration. As Shane Denson and Andreas Zutman have noted, this is generally true of most digital era serial narratives. Namely, they display a high degree of formal openness with regard to the order of texts and events, and they allow for a highly variable sequence of consumption. All right, so but this is not the only way in which this hyper-referential style manifests itself. So recent superhero movies like those of the MCU, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, also feature constant references to serial prehistories in other media. So to the earlier incarnations of iconic figures like the Hulk, for example. And for example, the opening titles of 2008's The Incredible Hulk restage the opening sequence of the TV show from the 1970s, which you see here below, fairly closely, almost shot for shot, although the shots are in different order. And by including these references to like earlier incarnations of the same figures, these films situate themselves in a history of larger Marvel stories and larger histories of superhero narratives in a variety of media. And they call attention to these earlier texts that can then again be sought out by the audiences of the films. So, and I argue in my chapter that all of this, all of these multiple levels of reference situate a kind of a fanished engagement with these films and with popular culture as the preferred mode of media consumption. So these films want you to engage these things as a comic book fan would. They want you to seek out all of the entries of the franchise and also go back and like get knowledgeable about the history of Marvel Comics, basically. So they invite particularly time-consuming reception practices, although they still remain open to these other levels of engagement. All right, so this is what I do in my second chapter. In the third chapter, then, I turn to a smaller group of recent, so quote-unquote, political superhero movies from the last decade or so. In particular, to a number of movies that have been discussed as example of political cinema. And these include, for example, the last two Captain America films, Christopher Nolan's The Dark Knight Rises, or James McTeague's V for Vendetta. Superhero narratives almost always tell stories about literal strongmen who defend societies from threats against the stability of their status quo. And because of this, they are always latently political. And scholars like Umberto Eco, Richard Reynolds, or David Graeber have pointed out the tensions and ideological implications that are inherent in this formula. However, while films of the genre have traditionally backgrounded these themes, these recent examples that I've just mentioned really make them or put an emphasis on them or have at least been discussed as political films in reviews and critical discussions. So in my chapter, I examine these movies in greater detail. I'm behind my presentation. It's always a bad sign when that happens. Yeah, I examine these films in greater detail and try to pinpoint what exactly these films do to encourage this kind of reception as a piece of political cinema. And this kind of reception also indicates that superhero movies have seen a kind of a cultural uplift where it's now okay to discuss these movies as a piece of serious popular culture in a way. So, and I try to pinpoint what exactly are the kind of thematic and film aesthetic strategies that produce this effect. And I describe it as my argument here is that these films subscribe to a form of cinematic populism that allows them to negotiate political subject matters in a way that appeals to observers from different partisan orientations and worldviews. And this cinematic populism revolves around a preoccupation with evocative settings, symbolically resonant images, and brief nods and allusions to current world events. But at the same time, it refrains from making a consistent argument about any kind of specific political issue. So they have ways of simulating, of producing a semblance of political meaning, but they don't really make an argument. And I think this is the key for why these films have been discussed as political films from observers from very different perspectives. And again, here's a film from the Marvel Cinematic Universe that exemplifies this pretty well, I think. So Captain America: The Winter Soldier was released in 2013 as the ninth film of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And it was like a huge commercial success, but it also managed this very positive public reception by critics. And it was prominently discussed as a political film. And interestingly, this perception was shared by commentators from different ends of the US-American political spectrum, including a reviewer by the alt-right Breitbart.com, as well as liberal bloggers and less partisan news outlets and websites. So I tried to pinpoint why exactly this is, and I think in Captain America and the other films of the series, this already starts with the protagonist, who is, as Jason Dittmar has called it, a nationalist superhero, which means a figure that explicitly identifies himself as a representative and defender of a specific nation state through name, uniform, and mission. And the Winter Soldier capitalizes on the latent political meanings of this figure by bringing the hero in conflict with a fictional American security agency, the spy agency SHIELD, which in the film is corrupted by the agents of a sinister terrorist conspiracy. So there's an inherent tension there because the hero then turns against his employer and against a corrupted version of the American security apparatus. All right. Aside from this, however, Captain America is a pretty flat icon rather than a rounded character, which is to say that he's a figure with only a few loosely sketched character traits, the most prominent of which is probably a vague sense of patriotic duty. And he has like few character relationships in the film, and he's kind of a fish-out-of-water character that has very few things that make him specific. He is kind of a projection screen or a foil for the audience, I would say. The hero is thus curiously underdefined, and a figure on which viewers can project their own conceptions of what precisely patriotism means. This flat characterization, furthermore, works in conjunction with the film's numerous spectacular action scenes that are usually built around the display. I don't know if you can see it. Yeah, are usually built around the display of the kind of superhuman strength and agility and power and endurance of the character. So Stan Christian, and these sequences are usually produced with a sophisticated combination of stunt work, practical effects, and digitally generated doubles of the actors that take their place in moments where it's too difficult to shoot the scene otherwise. Stan Christiansen has argued that this kind of cinematic apparatus stages the figure of the superhero as a cinematic attraction in its own right. That is, as a kind of cinematic marvel or spectacle that is interesting not because it signifies any kind of specific political leanings or ideologies, but because it is an object of our desire, so to speak. And as a result, the hero can become a larger-than-life presence whose appeal reaches across political divides. So this is the basic concept of all of these Captain America films. But in The Winter Soldier, this is furthermore combined with a way of staging kind of a political setting. So the film opens in downtown Washington, D.C., where all the different government buildings are, and it shows the morning workout routine of Captain America and his sidekick, the Falcon. And they pass all these iconic monumental sites in downtown D.C. with political meaning. So there's the World War II Memorial there, there's the Washington Monument and the Capitol there in the background. And all of this situates these figures as part of a pantheon of American heroes and political figures. At the same time, without making an argument of what kind of politics these figures signify, right? It's like an empty situation or situating there, staging a political meaning without really going into detail of what this should mean. And in the rest of the film, the film repeatedly alludes to, mostly through dialogue, through all kinds of current hot-button issues, like preventive military strikes, or the problematic reintegration of veterans into society, or the far-reaching implications of electronic surveillance. But rather than developing a coherent commentary on these themes, the film stays on this level of brief reference. It indexes these topics as something that has political significance, but it never really offers a kind of own commentary on it. And because of this, the audiences can read their own political meanings into this film. And in my chapter, I argue that this kind of strategy is actually at work in a number of superhero movies. And I don't do it now, but I offer a detailed reading of V for Vendetta, and I argue that similar strategies are at work there. And this allows these films also to produce a kind of political impact outside of merely reviews or discussion. So in the case of V for Vendetta, of course, this movie was instrumental in popularizing the use of the Guy Fawkes mask as a symbol of international street activism. And this mask is also used by protesters of various stripes and political allegiances, both on the left and on the right. And interestingly, recently, this can also be observed with the Captain America costume. So these are shots from this year. So, of course, I'm an Americanist and the United States are in turmoil right now. This is an alt-right activist on a street protest in Berkeley. Hate speech is free speech. He wears the Captain America t-shirt. And on the Women's March, these two protesters here in January this year in Washington, D.C., protesters from the left also appropriate this imagery as a kind of political symbol and invest it with their own meanings. And the larger argument that I make here is that these films manage to put these images into circulation and thereby, on the one hand, create a kind of public awareness and a kind of a political resonance somehow without actually being political. So they manage to put themselves into circulation to be visible, and this then supports again the franchises and the commercial imperatives that put these movies into the theaters in the first place. Very interesting, of course, in the case of the Guy Fawkes mask, every mask is a licensed merchandising product of owned by Time Warner. So all of the, in some way or other, returns get channeled back into the valorization processes that also inform the movies. All right. And my voice is about to give in, but I'm also almost done. I'm coming now through my last chapter, and this is one that is the most under construction right now. So I won't say as much about this as I did about the other ones. But in this chapter, which is the penultimate chapter of the dissertation, so the last chapter before the conclusion, and it focuses on the ways in which superhero movies position themselves within the discourses and debates and media of an online fan culture in order to secure the support of media fans. Yeah. And to do so, it considers two or three movies, I haven't yet really decided, from two different complementary perspectives. On the one hand, I examine how recent films of the genre rely on the affordances of digital cinema and computer-generated imagery to translate the aesthetics of superhero comics to the big screen. So in particular, I focus on spectacular action scenes that put the superhuman abilities of the heroes on display and which somehow evoke the look and feel of the comic book medium. So there's a number of scenes in the Avengers movies, for example, where all the heroes are framed in the same image. And this kind of evokes the look of a comic book's last page, where I think the film tries to convey a certain kind of allegiance to the comic book aesthetics as a way of appealing to a fan audience. And Aaron Taylor has discussed moments like these as a form of cultic management, that is, as a textual strategy that aims at appeasing and appealing to fans and fan-oriented publications in order to secure their support for a positive reception. Yeah. On the other hand, my chapter also considers how smaller bits and pieces and fragments and segments of superhero movies circulate through the media of a fan culture in the form of trailers, previews, leaked footage, set photos, or rumors about the production. So before these films are actually released to theaters. And I observe a number of fan media, like the website superherohype.com, ionline.com, or comicbookmovie.com, that use these bits and pieces of films to build anticipation and awareness before these films appear in the theaters. And the most obvious example of this, which I probably will discuss in my chapter, is the 2016 film Deadpool, which was stuck in development hell for several years, until somebody involved in the production leaked concept footage from the opening sequence of the film, a pre-visualization concept footage online, and managed to rally support for the making of the film. And eventually the film was made and became one of the highest grossing films of the year. And I consider this as a form of field testing or proof of concept, where the potential to appeal to fan audiences is tested by leaking this footage, and then eventually a kind of momentum is built that gets this film put into production again. And then the film that is released to theaters also has to respond to the building anticipation and has to actually deliver on the things that it promised or that fans read into the film before it actually existed. Yeah, so there's a complex dialectic going on there somehow. Yeah, this is after this was the fourth chapter. Afterwards, I will have a conclusion where all of this ties nicely together. And I think I just right now I can only restate the things I've been saying all the time. That my central claims are that these films try to shape the environment in which they circulate. That they command our attention, seek to generate favorable reception, and try to insert themselves into the fan culture. And this is a larger claim I want to make of a larger regime of current popular culture that increasingly promotes these complex serial formats and wants us to engage in intensified media consumption and attempts to capitalize on our cultural production. And I stop here. Thank you. Thank you.